Okay, let's get started then, ladies and gentlemen. So, you're here for exam prep number one. We're kicking off Tech Ed exam preps this week with this first session. We're going to be covering exams 7410 and part of 7417. And that's towards the MCSA on Windows Server 2012. This session is EXM01. And as I said before, we'll be doing a repeat of this on Wednesday, which is EXM13, just in case you have friends that miss this one. My name is Chris Rhodes. My principal job is that I'm an MCT, a Microsoft Certified Trainer, and I'm here at Tech Ed as an MCT ambassador. There are several of us. There's my colleague Keith at the back also. Feel free to come and speak to us this week if you have any questions regarding not just this, but any exam, certification, learning. That's what we're here for. The ambassadors are here to help you get certified, basically. And we have Certification Central right behind you when you walk out, where you can take tests and practice tests as well. So come and talk to us and use the facilities while you're here. And we'll talk more about testing in a minute as well. I'm also a Windows MVP. So if you have any questions around Windows, do give me a shout. So what we're going to have a look at, first of all, is a bit of an overview of certification, just to really set the scene and to give you an idea of where things sit in the big scheme of things. So who's seen this triangle before here? We have a picture of the certification stack, effectively, starting with the associate, Microsoft, the MTA, the associate level. Has anyone done any MTA exams? A couple of you? Okay. Most people are going to come in around this level to get the MCSA, and maybe build it onwards towards MCSE, the kind of expert level as well. Some people may want to do that, and we'll explain that in a minute as well. And you can also go beyond that up to the master's level as well. We have the Solutions Masters as well. So for most of us here, we're back to old familiar terms that were around a few years ago, in fact. Some of you may recognize these, well, the initials anyway, the MCSA, MCSE. These have been around before, but they've been relaunched. They've been rebranded. It's a whole new rebirth, a whole new certification, a whole new set of exams. So what I'm trying to help you with today is to help you earn your MCSA, your Microsoft Certified Solutions Associate level. Okay, so Windows Server 2012 is one of the MCSAs you can get. To get that, there is a couple of routes you can take. You can take exam 410, plus 411, and 412. That will earn you the badge of Microsoft Certified Solutions Associate on Windows Server 2012. There are several MCSAs, but this one is certified in Server 2012 particularly. This is one route people will take, and most people here in this room, I'm imagining, will probably want to take this route because they're new to technology. Maybe they haven't got previous certification in 2008, for example, and most people are going to want to walk up that ladder in that way. We would suggest that you take them in this sequence. That's not technically required. You can take them in reverse sequence if you like, but it makes sense to follow that pattern, to go to the 410 first, then take 411, and then 412 afterwards. Okay? So for most people, that's how you're going to go and take it. The other option you've got, if you're allowed to take it, is the 417. The 417 is those three exams we've just mentioned, but taken as one. So you'll sit one exam, and like have to pay for one only, but you'll take those three individual tests inside of that one exam time frame. You're entitled to go for the 417 if you have any of the certifications on the left-hand side of the picture here. So notably things like if you're an MCSA in Server 2008, or you're an MCITP in Enterprise Messaging, for example, or you're a Desktop Administrator for Windows 7. If you have any of those prerequisites on the left-hand side, then you're entitled to take 417. So for some of you, that might be an easier route in terms of cost and time spent actually taking exams. Okay, but if you do not have one of those on the left, then I'm afraid you have to do the full track, the 410, 11, and 12. Okay, so what we're going to be covering today is specifically the 410 content. As such, that represents one-third of the 417 exam. So I hope that makes sense, because a couple of people were asking at the beginning, you know, how much of the 417 you're actually covering today. So in effect, I'm covering one-third of the 417 content. My colleague afterwards is going to be presenting on the 411 and 412, thus finishing off on the 417 content also. So I hope that makes sense. MCSA is a standalone qualification. You can take that, earn it, wear the badge with pride, that's great. But you can also put it towards MCSE qualifications if you want. So as you go up that pyramid that we saw before, that we have six MCSEs that the MCSA is a prerequisite for. So, for example, a gentleman up front was asking me about 413, 414. Those could be added to an MCSA in order to get your server infrastructure MCSE. Okay? We have boards at the back of the room here, and also in our certification rooms as well, which explain all the tracks. We have them all put out on the boards on the easels at the back of the room. So do have a look at those on your way out, or speak to one of the ambassadors. We can help you with your, you know, career plan and give you some guidance on what to do next and where to go with that. But for many people, this is a kind of an important foundation in order to progress on to other qualifications as well. So first of all, any questions around that? Feel free to ask. Okay. All right, so moving on then. Let's just spend a couple of minutes, before we get into the 410 content, just talking about the exam experience. Who's not done an exam in around about the last year or so? Who's not done an exam? Okay. I ask that question because even if you have done exams before, the format has changed quite a lot recently. So if you haven't done an exam in the last 12 months, things are different now. So I'm going to just go through some, what to expect really from an exam candidate point of view, and maybe give you some insights into what to expect from the sort of more recent generation of exams that Microsoft Learning have been putting out, such as the Server 2012. So let's spend a couple of minutes just going through this. The exam internals. The exams themselves require that you sign up for an NDA at the beginning of the test. Okay, so as such, you can't discuss the content. Please remember this when you're sitting the exam. Maybe you're sitting it this week, as some of you are. Please keep to yourselves the information from the exam itself. You cannot discuss questions and answers and so on with family or friends. You'll get approximately 50 questions. I say approximately because, A, honestly, I don't know, and, B, they can change this at any time. Each exam is around about 50 or so questions, so expect that, and expect to have a couple of hours to do it in. Those can change. They can move the goalposts if they want to. 700 is always the passing mark. You're graded out of 1,000 points. 700 is always the passing grade, all right? But that does not necessarily mean 70%. Okay, there is sort of scoring that goes on behind the scenes that you and I won't see here that will actually give you the cut score. But 700 is the aiming point. If you get anything above 700, great. Okay, for some people, 700 is just enough, and that's perfect. All right? Under 700 means you need to take it again. There are no partial credits. If you get half a question right, you don't get any points. All right? You only get points for completed, 100% complete questions answered. So, as I say, the exams have a cut score. That cut score can be changed by Microsoft if they feel it's too easy or too hard. They monitor this over time. We'll never see that. All we see is the public-facing 700 points score on the sheets. Some questions may be on the exam and not be marked. Sometimes they'll add questions to the pool, and so you may see some beta questions. So don't be surprised about that. If you're signing into the exam and they say, some of the questions you're going to see today will not be marked, that's intentional. They may be developing some new questions and they're trying them out on you as part of your exam, but those are going to be nothing to do with the scoring of your particular test. They're just trying them out on you to see how they fit. Okay? Expect to have a blend of different question types. Did anyone attend the certification and you session in here yesterday? So my colleague David was going through and explaining about all the different kinds of questions we have here. So that's a session worth looking back up on if you missed it, because that explains about all the different question types, and I have a quick summary of those over here that you can look up on. If you go on the Microsoft.com/learning website, there are actually videos that you can go through that explain all the different types of questions to expect. You'll have some multiple choice. Okay, so straightforward, you know, pick one from A, B, C, or D. That's pretty straightforward. But there's also going to be things like drag and drop, build list, hot areas. I don't have time now to go into them all, but there's a page here you can go visit to give you an explanation of them. There's a YouTube channel for Microsoft Learning that explains some of them on there as well. Or come and speak to us at the end. I also want to give you some tips. I've lost count. I've done about 60 MCP exams in my time. So I like to think that I have sort of refined my technique more or less over the years. So let me give you some pieces of advice. Questions are not designed to trick people. Sometimes you may think that, but it's not the truth. Who's ever sat an exam and thought, hey, they're trying to trick me out here? No, they're not. The exams are wholly designed to discriminate. And when I say discriminate, what I mean is they want to discriminate the qualified candidate from the unqualified candidate. That's all we're trying to achieve. We want to make sure that the person that knows their technology can shine through and pass the exam. We want them to pass. Likewise, the person who is not qualified and who doesn't deserve it, we want them to fail. So the questions are designed to separate those two, okay? But we do not design it to trick people. There is no trick questions and answers. One common question people ask me is, if I understand best practices, does that mean I'm always going to get the right answer? No. Read the question. Your question may not have anything to do with best practice. We don't really care about best practice when it comes to certification. That's what you do in your day job, right? What we want to know is, do you know the product? You might get a question that says, you want to configure this a certain way. And that configuration may be completely against the grain of best practice, but that doesn't matter. If that's what the question is asking you to do, that's how you have to answer it. So best practice is not all that useful to know as far as exams are concerned. That might be useful for the day job, though. One question I get a lot is, should I review my questions? When I get to the end, I have a period of review, so I can go back through any of my questions and review them individually or all of them at once. It's up to you. All I will say is, I've had some people come to me and say, I wish I hadn't have gone through the questions like 5 times because I've ended up talking myself out of the right answer on a few questions and I've missed out by 1 or 2 points. I've had a few experiences relayed to me like that. So it is useful to review. I do go back personally and check out a couple of questions. If I'm not sure, I'll usually mark them for review. But I don't personally, this is my own personal opinion, I don't go back over the whole set of questions 2 or 3 times. Once I've answered a question, I never really go back and change it unless I've marked it for review. Now, that's just my personal way of doing things, but I found it works. Okay, so that's my little tip for you. So, but you do use that. Some people do find the review process very useful, but I'm usually confident. When I've put my answer down, I don't change it unless I've already flagged it up as I'm not sure and I've marked it for review in that case. I might review maybe 4 or 5 at the end I've marked. Otherwise, I don't touch them. Once they're in, they're committed, that's it. I usually find my gut reaction answer is the right answer. Yeah, that's what I find anyway. Do you want to watch the clock? Some people do need to. On the whole, I don't think you need to. I think they're relatively generous with the time, but all the same, see how you're going. It's not often people run out of time. Sometimes they do during review because they're going back over them, but generally speaking, you don't need to watch the clock. Just get on and answer the questions, all right? Don't spend too much time sitting there looking at the clock in the corner. One really massive piece of advice, we're going to spend some time on this, is use the objective domain that's published on the web page to guide your revision. This is where people go wrong because they go, well, I didn't expect this to come up on the exam. Why are they asking me this? Well, did you actually look at the exam OD? Because that's where it spells out what we're going to cover, what we're going to test you on. There are no hidden surprises. If it's on the exam OD, it's fair game for exam questions. So we're going to go through that in a few seconds. But best of all, really, trust your instincts. As I say, gut reaction answers are usually the right ones. Stick with your reaction on that. You'll go fine. Okay, so exam objectives then. For every exam that Microsoft have, we have a web page, which I've just clicked here, that will show you what is covered on there. It'll also give you some information about background to it, but particularly I want to focus your attention on skills measured. There's a section here called skills measured, and we're going to walk through that, that goes through point by point what you can expect to come up on the exam. So you need to be prepared on all of those things. All right, I have no idea what questions you're going to get. You may not get a question on every single thing from every single sub-bullet point, but you should be prepared for that. All right, so in terms of revision, make sure you're ticking off every single section and subsection on that when you're revising. Okay, that way you're fully prepared as best as possible. Okay, so let's get into the 410. We're going to talk about the OD areas, and then we'll go drill down on some of those, and we'll give you some advice and some tips, and also some practice questions along the way to see if you guys are ready or not. Okay, so let's start with the 410 content. When we look on that web page I just described, there are, 6 different subtopic areas. So the percentages of those you can see on the screen behind me, it's roughly 15 to 20% for each of those areas. It might vary depending on what questions you get on the day. So we have things like install and configure servers. We have configure the server roles and features on your servers. We've got Hyper-V called out specifically as well. That's an important area on this exam, so make sure you know your virtualization. We've also got core network services, how to deploy and configure core network services. And I'll expand these in a minute. We also have installing and administering Active Directory, and finally, creating and managing group policy. Those are the 6 main areas. The OD spells these out, and we're going to break those down in just a second. So let's start with the first one here, installing and configuring servers. Okay, so hands up, who's actually installed Server 2012? Pretty much everybody. If you haven't, you need to. You need to have the practice at doing this in all kinds of different ways. All right, so let's see those show of hands again, which was like 95% of people just there. Let's see those show of hands if you've installed Server Core. Put your hands up. Not as many people. Server Core is part of the product. You might install it in full GUI, or you might install it in Server Core. Expect questions on both. All right, not as many people use Server Core in a production environment as the full GUI installation. You are expected to know both of those things. In some cases, it's more appropriate to deploy a Server Core machine for security reasons, maybe, or whatever reason. So you need to know how to set those up and configure them. So for example, does anyone know what I might use to help me configure Server Core once I've installed it? What might I use? I could use PowerShell, yep. What else? Tools from another machine, or sconfig, yeah. Several answers, in fact, and that's a good answer, because there are several ways to do many things. There are many ways to kind of achieve the goal here, and you need to know those. So PowerShell, sconfig, remotely administering servers from server manager, from another computer, all of the above. Okay, so you need to know, you need to be familiar with that and have tried them out as well. In terms of also configuring servers, server manager is a new experience now. It's a different interface to what you've had before. It allows you to configure just not just one server you're working on, but actually many servers. So I might have a dozen servers in my environment I want to administer. I need to group them together. Does anyone know the name for that group? Yeah, nice one. Server pool. You can create a pool or multiple pools of servers for administration. So you might want to add several servers together into a bunch of them into a group so that you can manage them from the one place. So you have that single seat administration, whether it's checking Event Viewer or it's adding roles and features, you can actually do all of that from one place. But you want to add the servers into a pool, first of all, so you can administer them from your desktop machine or from another server. Excuse me one sec. Once you've added a server to, oh, by the way, what do we have to do first? Before we can add a server to a pool, is there anything we need to do first? Yeah, before we add it to Server Manager, is there anything else we need to do? Enable remote administration. Well, that's a good point. To do this, we do need a remote administration enabling, but that is enabled by default, okay? Unless your server is in a work group or something, if it's in the same domain, there's no extra work required. Remote administration is turned on by default in Server 2012. So just make sure you know the principle about how do I add it into a server pool? How do I, you know, practice this? How do I control a second, third, fourth server from one point? Make sure you've practiced that kind of stuff out before you take the test. We also have down here local storage. And storage has changed quite a bit in Server 2012. Who's familiar with storage pools? Okay, about 25% of you, and that's not enough. You all need to be familiar with storage pools. Storage pools is the new way we look at virtualizing, really, the storage. So I might have a couple of disks in my server, but I might want to aggregate them together and treat them as a pooled resource. Maybe I want to make a disk mirror or a three-way mirror. These are the kinds of things they will ask you to know, that they assume that you know how to do. So you'll need to know about things like thin provisioning for disks, for example. Does anybody know what thin provisioning is? Go on, what's thin provisioning? Go on, go ahead.
It's where you set the amount that it can grow to, but it starts off at, you know, a gig when you give it to grow to 50.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It freaks people out, really, when you say, I'm going to create like a 1 terabyte storage pool, but I only have a 500 gigabyte disk. How is that possible? But that's thin provisioning. You can always add the extra storage you need later on, but you might just want to create a big volume now that is way bigger than what you've actually got underneath. And that's really the essence of storage pools. You can have virtual disks in there, physical disks in there, but you can do extra things with storage pools that you couldn't do just with straightforward regular disks before. So that's a necessary part of really building your server, getting the disk storage ready for it, for whatever its intended purpose in life is going to be. Maybe it's going to be an application server or a file server, whatever. Configuring the storage for that is an important primary task when you're preparing your server for day one, okay? So make sure you're familiar with the disk management interfaces that you've got, mostly within Server Manager particularly. A lot of this is done within the Server Manager program. So make sure you're fluent with that in terms of how to set up a storage pool and how to do those kinds of disks I've mentioned, okay? There are several ways to achieve that stuff. You could do some of it in the disk management tool a little bit as well, and maybe from a command line. But server manager is where most people are going to do storage pools and configure that stuff. Okay, you can do it through PowerShell as well, like everything else. In terms of kind of finishing off on this section here, I would advise some of you also to have a look at some of the hands-on labs that are here this week. Has anybody tried some yet? A couple of you? Okay, it's only Monday, so plenty of time. I've called out a couple of the hands-on labs, specifically 201 and 306, are definitely fit into this category that we've been talking about here. So if you need to try some of those things out, if you need to try out storage and you've never done a storage pool, we've got a lab for that downstairs you can have a look at on the first floor, okay? So does anyone have any questions on the first section before we move on?
Will the hands-on lab cover every aspect of the storage pool that are kind of bullet points of what you can do?
I think so. I haven't tested it. Okay. I think so. But there's definitely a storage pool's hands-on lab downstairs. I didn't run it yet. But if they don't cover what we are needing for this, then I think it will. Try it out. I think that's the 306 one, I think. Okay, so in terms of the content here, a lot of this is new and different to what you may have done in 2008. The way we provision servers now, that someone mentioned PowerShell, for example, the way we can install features and what have you from PowerShell now is kind of a new thing. We had it before a little bit in 2008, but we've gone for it wholesale a lot more nowadays in Server 2012. So let's also have a look at a practice question here. I've got a few of these as we go through, and I've taken these from MeasureUp. You can take measure up practice tests in the room next door to us, by the way, if you want to try any of these kinds of things out. So let's have a look, see if we can get this between us. So practice question number one. You manage a server named Server 1 that runs Microsoft Windows Server 2012. The server has a graphical user interface, or a GUI. You plan to convert the Windows Server 2012 installation to a Server Core installation by using PowerShell. Okay. What feature needs to be removed? So we have three answers: Server GUI Shell, Server GUI Management Infra, or Desktop Experience. What do you think? Shout it out. Oh, lots of, a bit of everything there. Okay, it's actually B. If you didn't know that, go check it out, all right? This is not the complete PowerShell command here, by the way. This is just part of it. But that's something we can do nowadays. We can actually have a full server GUI installed because, let's face it, most of us prefer that, don't we? When we're administering servers, we prefer the GUI because we're lazy. That's fine. You can prep your server. Get it done. Get all the features and everything configured and then take it down to Server Core afterwards to optimize it for security. We can do that, all right? And we can go back the other way. There's also a third, what's called mini shell experience as well. Who's tried mini shell? If you haven't, go check it out. Do have a play with that. Because you can actually flip to like a halfway house mode where it's like halfway between the GUI and a Server Core installation. It's called mini shell. Most people haven't even heard of that. So go and check that out as well. But specifically in this case here, we're asking you to know that it is possible to flip from one mode of Windows, if you will, to another. In this case, using PowerShell. And PowerShell shouldn't come as a surprise. This product is riddled with PowerShell commands, all right? And that's a good thing for administration. If you're not so hot on PowerShell, do get skilled up on that. There are sessions on during the week here that you can do on PowerShell. But PowerShell is very important. So let's have a quick show of hands. Who would rate themselves pretty well on PowerShell? About half. Not enough, though. All right? From this day on, you know, make it your aim in life to try and do as much as possible in PowerShell to get yourself familiar with that. Because you'll be amazed at just how many functions and commandlets and modules, in fact. There are dozens of modules in Server 2012 for PowerShell. So you can administer just about everything. I don't think there's much you cannot administer using PowerShell. So this is just one example of that. In fact, that's the only way to do it, actually, as well. Okay, so let's move on to our second OD area. The second OD area is about configuring server roles and features. So I think pretty much everybody here should know that, you know, nowadays when we install a server, it doesn't do much out of the box. We have to tell it what we want it to do. We want it to be a domain controller. We want it to be a file server. We have to add that role or feature to it to accomplish that. So a couple of the ones they've picked out here specifically are the file sharing, the file and print sharing role, And also making sure that you really know how to do that storage underneath on that as well. So for example, configuring file shares isn't especially new. File shares have been on servers for years, but do you know all the different ways to do that? You know, there are different MMC snap-ins, there are PowerShell ways to do this. So get familiar, even if you think, okay, I've done this before on Server 2008, I can configure a file share, that's not difficult. Well, actually, maybe it's new now. Maybe there's a new method you didn't know about. Okay, so check that out. And again, in most cases, there's always gonna be a PowerShell way of doing it. So I would urge you to kind of find new ways to accomplish old tasks, all right? If you think, okay, I've done this before, don't rely on that. You can rest on your laurels here and end up failing because you didn't realize there was a new tool or a new PowerShell method to administer whatever the thing is. Okay, so do look out of your way, out of your comfort zone, especially from the point of view of PowerShell commands. I find that that's something that people aren't prepared enough for. So in terms of configuring printing and file sharing, let's have a look at some of that stuff. One area I just wanted to pick out here is that under file sharing, have we heard of the dynamic access control feature in Windows Server? Yeah? That is specifically covered on the 4.12 exam. That's listed on the OD for that exam and not for this one. So in this particular area, we're looking at, can you set up file sharing? Can you set up permissions, NTFS permissions, or what I would call the regular bread and butter type things that an administrator might need to do in provisioning storage and shares. Dynamic access control is not listed on this particular OD, and it is on the 4.12. So if you're gonna do the 4.17, you need to know it either way. But as far as the 4.10 exam goes, you can kind of postpone revision on that one until you get to the 4.12. Learn how to do it the regular way, the old school way, if you will, of setting up shares and permissions. As far as printing goes, there have been some changes in more recent times about printing and how that's evolved, really, in terms of administration. So for example, who's familiar with the print management MMC tool? About half of you. Yeah, I use that quite a lot in terms of when I'm setting up print servers. You can remotely administer print servers with this. You can do this from a desktop machine. A Windows 8 or a Windows 7 machine will have that tool installed by default anyway. But print management is a really useful tool. For example, we can actually deploy printers to group policy to distribute to your client machines by using that print management. We don't even need the group policy management tool to do this. We can do it all within print management. I can create a printer in there, I can share it on a remote server if I want to, and then I can go ahead and publish that in group policy so that my client desktop machines get that sent out to them. Did you know you could do that? And that's pretty powerful. Some people are really enjoying using that in the workplace because it just simplifies that hassle job of getting printers to users' machines. But we can actually do that. We can do that remote publishing stuff to group policy all through the print management tool. So I definitely urge you to have a look around that. At first glance, it doesn't look all that complex. It looks more like just a print queue management tool, but it's more than that. You can add all your print servers into one view, deploy them, add them, change the drivers, and so forth. So make sure you have experience with that. Make sure you're familiar with EasyPrint. Okay, EasyPrint. Does anyone know what that means? What's EasyPrint? Yeah, go ahead. Right, yeah, it's to do remote sessions. Yeah. So we can actually have it remap their local printer through to remote sessions. So when they click print, they can have it come down out through their local print job. Yep. So that kind of thing is worth exploring. It's not something that you may have directly had contact with if you're just running a regular print server. It's something that is used in virtualization in that sense. What else have I got in my notes here? Configuring servers for remote management. Now, we already said, in fact, that remote administration is turned on by default, but that's not the whole story. We have this thing inside of Windows called WinRM, Windows Remote Management, and it's been in Windows for a couple of versions now. That is configurable. Has anyone configured it before? Why would I configure WinRM? What kinds of things might I be doing with that? Possibly, across the firewall. In terms of allowing the ports through, you mean? Yeah, that's possible. Also, something that I've sometimes done before is to limit which computers can remotely administer other computers. Okay, so there's a thing called trusted hosts, where you can limit which computers are allowed to talk to this server to administer it. Because you don't want just any computer being able to talk to your server. You may just want a couple of management workstations listed or other servers listed as computers which can talk inbound to this particular server that you're setting up. So that's sometimes done as a sort of a pre-production task in ensuring that you can administer it, but only from a subset of computers on the network. Okay? In terms of firewall, we'll come back to that in a minute, actually. We've got firewall coming up a little later. So those kinds of things are often command line. So specifically WinRM, there's a winrm.exe command line. So you do something like winrm s to configure that, and then the switch is going beyond that to configure the trusted hosts, for example. And I think that's the only way I know of doing that. So there's a lot of command line things. Even though you might install your server with a full GUI, there are still some things you've got to do from a command line. Winrm.exe is something to look up into and configure in configuring remote management, okay? We can also, by the way, configure that stuff through GPO as well. So most of you here are going to have domains, I imagine. So group policy is a logical way for us to be able to administer servers. And that also applies to what we call down-level servers as well. You could get asked questions on this exam about not just administering Server 2012 servers, but being able to administer from them older servers that you may have on the network as well, because you might have a mixture. Okay, some of you here are probably in that state where you've got some Server 2008, some Server 2012 computers. You may be required to administer both. Maybe from the newer platform, administer the old computers. So expect questions on that as well. So configuring our remote management might actually be on a Server 2008 computer. That's within scope on this exam. Okay, so let's have a look at a sample question on this one, for this topic area, to see how we do on this one. You create a volume on disk one on your server, and you create a shared folder on that volume. You want to enable the volume shadow copy service, or VSS, on the shared folder. What step can you take to accomplish this task? So before we answer the question here, so what exactly is volume shadow copy here? Why would we be doing this? What is the background to this question here? Right.
Come back to you. You can do like an hour, a per hour copy, and they can go on a tape or whatever, you can do this. That could be
helpful. Right. So users can access previous versions of files this way. I was doing something similar myself this morning where I was retrieving a previous version of a file that I had saved on my computer. And we can do this on the file server. So users can basically restore back their own previous versions of files here without needing to ask the administrator to go ahead and restore from backup for them. So it's really a self-service option once you've configured it. So the question here is, how do you configure it? How do I configure VSS? So what do you think here? Is it in the properties for the shared folder and enable shadow copy? Is it using the xcopy command to enable shadow copy for the shared folder? Or is it in the properties for the volume, enable shadow copy for the volume? Oh, you're a bit more confident there. Most people said C. One person says A, so who's right? It is C. It is C. It is the last one. That's where we do it. We do it on the properties of the volume. That's where we can configure that. Okay? So, yeah, this is part, really, of provisioning the file server role. A lot of file servers are going to have user data in there, and it makes logical sense, in most cases, to have a little bit of disk space given over to VSS so users can retrieve previous versions or even deleted files. And that's a self-service option. It's something I encourage administrators to set up when I'm teaching classes on this. I encourage them to do that. I say, however much disk space you've got, you know, maybe set aside about 20% extra so that you can enable VSS and give that 20% over to VSS. It makes total sense. It's going to save you time during restores anyway. Okay, now, next up, let's have a look at Hyper-V. Hyper-V is a core part of the product. I appreciate not everybody's going to use it on every server. You should be using it on some servers, at least in your organization. But Hyper-V is classed as a core part of the product, and you are examined on this. So if you're VMware people, too bad. You need to learn this. It's good for you to learn this anyway, by the way. It's definitely worth learning this. So just a quick show of hands. Who's actually using Hyper-V in their environment, whether it's on to Server 2012 or 2008? About a good half of you, at least. Okay. So get to grips with this. Even if you've used this on 2008, it's quite surprising just how many new features they've thrown into Server 2012. All right, so some of the basics about setting up a VM are pretty similar, but there's a lot of new stuff. I'd urge you to go out and look for that. It's actually very easy to find this information. You can find it on TechNet quite readily. There's a What's New in Hyper-V webpage on TechNet where you can just go through that stuff and find the information that I'm pertaining to here. But you should have good grounding in Hyper-V. We're not talking about necessarily making things like clustered Hyper-V installations here, but we are talking about the day-to-day stuff. Installing the role, installing virtual machines, configuring the settings for those virtual machines, configuring the storage for the virtual machines. Are you aware, for example, what a VHD file is? Okay, how about a VHDX? That's a new file type, okay? What's the difference between a VHD and a VHDX? One letter. Smart answer. I was waiting for that one letter difference. Yeah, there are some technical differences between them. Seek those out if you're not familiar with what those are. But it's a new thing. It's new for Server 2012. It's also compatible with Windows 8, but they're not backwardly compatible. So if you have some virtual machines you want to take from a Server 2012 box and put on a 2008 box, you want to stick with the VHD file type when you're doing that, okay? But saying that, you do need to understand the virtual disk storage types. For example, there are differencing disks where you can have a base hard drive and then you can have a differencing disk, which is like a top-up drive to that, where you could have several computers sharing the same base disk and then have numerous differencing disks on top of that to streamline the amount of storage space you need to store when you have multiple virtual machines, which are basically the same, almost the same. Okay, so differencing disks, we use those in the training environment quite a lot. We use them in the classroom a lot. In a production environment, we don't encourage that. But in a test environment, in a test or dev environment, that's definitely worthwhile looking into because it can save considerably on storage space. So definitely have a look into that. But you need to know about pass-through disks, virtual hard disks, VHDX files. You need to know how to really understand how those work, the differences between them, and also how you go about configuring things like virtual networking. All right, so we have different kinds of network switches now that we can configure. There's external networks, internal networks. You need to be familiar with the different kinds that you have and what the requirements for those are. So if you want to have an external network, what do you need? A NIC. If you want an internal network, you don't have to have any NICs, in fact. An internal network is purely virtualized. All right? It's just there for the virtual machines to use only. All right? A virtual machine on an internal network can only speak to other virtual machines on that same network. It cannot talk beyond that out onto the LAN at large. If you want to do that, it has to be an external network. Okay? So you need to be familiar with the different kinds that we have there. They've also added a lot of functionality, which I don't have time to drill into right here, which is interesting to talk about. They have a lot of stuff like for shared data centers. So you can actually have virtual IP addresses, where if you've got colo-located servers, you can have them using your own internal subnet range of IP addresses, even though they're on a completely different network, and treat them as if they're on your LAN. So there's a lot of that kind of functionality built in here, which, to be fair, you probably don't need to go into that kind of depth on, but you do need to know all the main tasks around setting up a virtual machine, setting up the virtual networking ahead of that. Please go through all the properties of a virtual machine. Make sure you understand all of those things. There are new options on there in Server 2012 that you won't have seen before if you're on Server 2008 right now, okay? So for example, dynamic memory. Does anybody know what dynamic memory is on Server 2012? Yeah, chap at the back in the blue.
Yeah, it basically
allows you
to start RAM.
I'm sorry, say again.
Yeah,
so we can do startup RAM, we can do maximum RAM, and we can have a flexible range. So there's weightings you can assign with that as well. And I find this a really useful feature. I often have multiple virtual machines running at the same time, all competing for a small amount of RAM. This is amazing, this feature. So again, for test and dev networks, that's particularly good. But actually, for production environments, it's also useful to have that balloon space that they can use. So they can use a shared amount of RAM for several VMs. Okay, and they'll assess between themselves who needs what, and they'll fight it out for who gets the RAM. Very useful feature. It means you can really consolidate more VMs on the same box than previously. You don't have to have the RAM fully dedicated for each VM all of the time. They can swap around and use the same shared memory. That's very useful. So you need to understand about some of those things. A lot of those things are new features, or they've improved the feature set. So like I say, if you're thinking, okay, Hyper-V, I did this in Server 2008 R2, I'm good on that. look again, actually, because there's a lot of underneath settings. Like I say, drill down, especially on the networking side of things. There's a lot of new sub-settings in the networking settings. If you expand the branches, you'll see what I mean. Okay. Gosh, what else is new on virtual machines? Replication, we get to more of that on other exams, to be honest with you. Not so much on here. It's more about configuring them, you know, creating a network, creating a virtual machine, creating the storage for those. The replication is covered, but not on this test, all right? It's good to know how Hyper-V replication works, but not so much for 410. Pass-through disks? Yep. Oh, yeah, fiber channel. That's a good one as well now. Yeah, fiber channel. So you may have some virtual machines that want to access fiber channel resources. We've got that. We've got that like virtual fiber channel adapter now we can use as well. Yeah, thank you. That's a new feature we got. Live migration, again, not so much for this particular topic. It's good to know. I definitely would learn that because it's an awesome feature. Live migration is brilliant. But clustering is a bit off topic for this test. It's going to be covered on the 412. You'll see later on. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I hear you. Good features, but I don't want to get people onto that for 410. This is more about setting it up, configuring it, getting your server ready, getting the VM ready. It's not so much on the more advanced side of things. So if you want to get into clustering of VMs and live migrations, Hyper-V replica, that's all good stuff to learn, but not for 410. Stick with the basics for this one. Okay, so let's have a look at a practice question on Hyper-V. It's actually to do with the RAM we were just talking about. So here we have a server called Server 1 running Windows Server 2012. It's got the Hyper-V role installed. You have a virtual machine named VM1 running on the Hyper-V host. VM1 is configured to use dynamic memory. You need to change the memory allocation settings for VM1. Which memory allocation setting cannot be changed while VM1 is running? Is it the minimum, the maximum, or the startup RAM? It is C, the startup RAM. Yep, well done if you said that. You were right. That guy's punching the air. Well, good for you. The startup RAM cannot be modified while the machine is running. You have to stop the machine. It has to be in a stopped state for you to change that. The other settings can potentially be modified in production use. Okay. Now, to be fair, this is a sample question from MeasureUp. We don't often see this kind of thing on an exam where we say which cannot be. It's usually the other way around. But just look out for the language on exam questions. Sometimes it's which can you not do. We're not trying to trick people. It's sometimes we want them to recognize what the limitations of something are. So you may get questions where we're sort of looking for the negative. We're saying, which can you not do? Often we'll ask things like, what do you do first? Or what do you need to do to get this working? So we're looking usually on more of the positive side of things. Okay, let's move on to our next section here. I think it's our fourth one here, is deploying and configuring core network services. And actually, this is where it gets pretty broad. Because Server 2012 is a big product, there's a lot in it, and Hyper-V is just one of those things. Here, in fact, we're also required to know quite a bit about some basic network services as well. Now, the good news is some of these are not new. Some of these things have been around a while, so if you've been administering DHCP before, some of the functionality in Server 2012 is identical to before. However, there's new features as well. So let's just go through the three topic headers. First of all, you need to be able to configure IP4 and IP6. Okay, now you should be at that point now of maturity in IT where you should be familiar with what's coming here. All right, IP6 has been around by default in Windows for some years. Okay, who's turned that off, by the way? Who's ever gone and turned off IP6? Oh my God, too many people. No, keep it on. You've got the wrong message. IP6 should be on by default. It is. Keep it on. Understand it and know how it works. I know some administrators, they've turned it off because simply they just don't understand how it works. If you're one of those people, educate yourself because it's good for you to have it. Okay? What does Windows Server use by default? IP4 or IP6? Yeah, it'll try, if possible, if it's configured, we'll use IP6 by default. Okay? There are reasons for that, but essentially, it should be left on by default. It's turned on for you, but you need to appreciate how it works. So make sure you understand the differences between the different kinds of IPv6 addresses that you might come across. So for example, there are link local addresses, site local addresses, global addresses. Get familiar with the conventions on those. It's actually not as difficult as it first sounds. You don't need to be a kind of complete wizzo and understand everything about IPv6, because you could spend like the rest of this month learning IPv6 and still not know it all. That's not the level you need to go at. You need to know how to configure it. Okay, maybe for this server, but maybe also for other computers on your network. Maybe you're supporting client machines and you need to give out the prefix to the client machines from your DHCP server. Okay, it's not that difficult to do, but many of you here probably won't have done that yet. All right, most of us here probably still run IP4 networks, or a mixture where you've got IP4 and IP6, but haven't done much with the IP6. Now's the time to get into it, folks. Learn it, because it's not as difficult as it first sounds. All right, one of the things you've got support for very nicely in DHCP nowadays is the IP6 information that we can give out to client machines, assuming the router isn't already doing that for you, which it usually does on an IP6 network. So you need to be familiar with it. Yep, sorry, got a question here.
Sure. What if your DHCP server is 2008? Would you still want to have IPv6?
Sure, it's 2008 server also has IP6 on by default. No change there. Yep, no change. And that's when it first came in. 2008 RTM was the Windows Server version that first gave us IP6 on by default. Okay, so that's back in the kind of the Vista time frame, whenever that was, whenever that first came out. So, yep, no change in this respect. It's just that it's becoming slightly more important for us to focus on this, and we're starting to see more things like DNS and DHCP fit in with that nowadays. So it's more important for you guys to know how it operates. Yes, question, sir. Yeah, that's a good question. So if you can't hear that from this guy, how much do you need to know about subnetting and the /24 type stuff? All of that. Yeah, reading a book is difficult on that one. I mean, there are some videos online. There are some good, yeah, self-based learning tools you've got. We actually teach this on the 2410 course as well. So an instructor-led course is a good way. But yeah, just coming back to your original question, how much do I need to know about IPv4 addressing? Yeah, you do. We assume you know that. I've talked about IPv6 quite a bit here, but we do assume you guys have got a really good handle on IPv4. Why? Because that's still the predominant technology today. That's still what your data centers are going to be running by far and away the most oftentimes. So you need to know how to subnet. You need to know what like /24 means or /23. You need to understand those things and how to configure that on a server. Okay? So if you've been given a subnet range of like here's /22, go make that work on your server there. You need to know what that means and how you can get an IP address from that range and assign it on that server, and how to set up the default gateway appropriately as well. So yep, subnetting and supernetting, all those things that go with that, you are expected to know here for that first bullet. Yeah, there's a chap over here. So for network load balancing, can we run IP4 and 6 consecutively? I'm trying to visualize the page here. To be honest, I don't want to put you off here, but that's slightly off topic for the thing in hand here. But I think we can. You can have both at the same time, I think. I'd have to check it. I can check it afterwards on my virtual machine if you like. I don't want to say definitely yes. I'm sort of 90% sure, but I can check it afterwards. Come see me afterwards. Sorry, can it be?
They need to make the TCP/IP class.
Yeah.
Like it used to be an MLC class.
Oh, yeah, we used to have a 5-day class for TCP/IP, yeah. And unfortunately, that's become, we regard that now as just, well, it's mainstream technology. Everybody should just know that somehow. And unfortunately, you know, that's not the case. Some people here are coming new into the industry and they hadn't grown up on that. But we kind of assume, we don't, even though it's not called out in a big way here, we do assume that people have got that good grounding in subnetting and supernetting and all those skills. This is what we mean by core networking, configuring the core networking, of getting your server, talking to the clients, talking to the other devices on the route, like on the network, like the router. We assume that you guys can configure all of that and make everybody else talk with that as well by setting up the DHCP scope so that all the client machines get allocated the correct information as well. So some of this stuff, if you've done it before, isn't that different here. I'll be honest with you. It's very similar to what you may have done in 2003 or 2008, but it's still required as a core skill on the 410 exam. All right? So yeah, according to the chap here, you've got to know your IP subnetting. You've got to know what that like slash 24 means. Yeah, come and see me afterwards. Yes, sir. Good question. So the question is, what about redundant DHCP servers? This exam isn't focusing on too much of the advanced services, okay? So we don't go into clustering, we don't go into NLB and those kinds of things. The high availability type options we don't really cover on 410. We're more here about straightforward setting it up. So for example, with DHCP here, it's what do you need to do to get a DHCP server up and running, and what do I next do on that to get my clients to get an IP address? So for example, you'll be required to know that you have to authorize a DHCP server before it will start working. So you need to understand how you go about doing that. You can pre-authorize the server, or you can authorize it as you're provisioning it. Those are the kinds of things that we're measuring here. We're not measuring the more complex stuff like the DHCP failover stuff. We're not getting into that on the 410. We do cover that on other Windows Server tests, but not this one. All right, this is more straightforwardly about get that service working in the more basic way. And the same for DNS. We haven't talked about that one yet, but DNS in the same fashion. You need to know how to build a DNS server, the different kinds of zones that you might want to create on that, and also the different types of records you'd create inside of a DNS zone. So make sure you know what a PTR record is, what a CNAME record is, what an A record is, and why you would need to create some of those manually sometimes, as well as having records populated automatically most of the time. There are some cases where you've got to go in and you've got to set up a zone, or you've got to set up a particular type of record for a certain service or application. So you've got to roll your sleeves up and know how to do that. Okay? And also from a command line, and we've strayed away from that for 10 minutes or so, but command line ways, that we have dnscmd.exe, which is our administration interface for DNS. We've also got some PowerShell commands. There's a DNS module for PowerShell. So you can add records and zones and stuff like that from PowerShell nowadays too. Okay? So again, I talked to the people here who have got some more experience in previous versions. If you've set up a DNS zone before and you think, yeah, I know all that, don't be caught out. They might ask you to do it in PowerShell. Okay, so go seek out the PowerShell module for DNS and see what's in it, and see the kinds of things we can do. But things like DNSCMD are being deprecated in favor of the PowerShell module. And that's the same for a lot of things nowadays. Whether it was previously a command line tool, nowadays we're trying to get you to do that in PowerShell instead. And both might be living side by side for the time being, but long term, PowerShell is the way forwards. Okay? Where are we here? So also things like root hints, make sure you know how to configure root hints here, how to configure DNS forwarding. I would regard those as the kind of sort of setup tasks. If I was building a new network today, those are the kinds of things I would expect you to know how to do. If I had somebody on my team who had done the 410 exam, I should be confident to say, you've got the 410 exam, you know how to build DNS, I want you to go and set up a new DNS server, I want you to get forwarding configured to talk to our internet provider to resolve internet names. Off you go. I should be safe in the knowledge that person has the skills to go ahead and build that without me telling them anything else. Okay? Oh, I've also got Hands-On Lab 208, useful for this section here as well. Okay, quick practice question before we move on to our next section here then. You've got a server called Server 1 running Windows Server 2012. It's got the DNS server role installed. Server 1 is joined to your Active Directory domain. Users that have computers joined to the same domain are reporting they are not able to resolve any server names. After troubleshooting this issue, you find that the DNS IP address configured on the clients is different from the IP address of Server 1. You need to prevent this issue in the future. What should you do? Should you A, create a static IP address for Server 1? Should you add a PTR DNS resource record for Server 1? Or should you configure static IP addresses for the clients? Yeah, it's A, configure a static IP address for the server. So basically, your clients know about a DNS server that they're supposed to be using, but they are knowing about the wrong IP address for that. You could either go around and tell all the clients to use something different, or just change the server. So here, we're thinking the easiest thing is just change the server once, and then everybody is in line with that configuration. Okay. But you could get questions around the different kinds of records. So, for example, let's pick up on PTR record. Where would I see a PTR record? In a reverse zone. And if you don't know the difference between a reverse zone and a forward zone, well, come and talk to me at the end. I can put you straight. But that's the kind of thing we expect you to know. What records go where? Where would you put a CNAME record? Where would you put a PTR record? Whereabouts exactly would you configure that and why? Okay, next section. I think we're almost there. Last but one. So our penultimate section here is installing an Arbanista Active Directory. And again, it's a bit of a wow moment here because actually Active Directory is a huge technology area in its own right. And I could spend all day long talking about Active Directory. But here's the things you need to know. In Server 2012, there are loads of new features for Active Directory. Lots more PowerShell commandlets. We had some before in R2, but we've got loads more of those. One of the principal differences is the provisioning process. So how do I build a domain controller? DC promo? Oh, no. Well, yes and no. Okay. Traditionally, DC promo would be your answer. If I want to build a domain controller, I have to install the ADDS role. And once I've done that, I would then go, traditionally anyway, on the older versions, I'd then go and run DC promo. Okay, that's not the case now. You actually have one wizard lead into the other, so it's not actually necessary to do it in two parts exactly, because once you've installed the role, it nowadays automatically takes you into the provisioning part. But DC promo still kind of exists, but you can only use it for unattended scripted installations of a domain controller. That's all it can do. DC promo is not an interactive tool anymore. So here's a question, folks. Who knows? How do I go and build a new domain controller then? What's the equivalent of DC promo nowadays? Add a role? I could do that, but what, there's a command line. How would I do it from a command line? Nope, it's not that one. It's a PowerShell command. Install feature would have to come first. You'd have to install the role, but once you've installed the role, you still have to do the next step, which is to build the domain controller itself. It's install eight, no, hang on, let me just check what I wrote. Make sure I give you the right information here. I got it written down. Install ADDS domain controller is the PowerShell command that we execute now to build that. If you're running it through the GUI, it's going to run that underneath for you. But if you want to automate stuff or you just prefer PowerShell, which, you know, you should, it's install ADDS domain controller is the command that you want to look for here. DC promo is deprecated. Okay, as I say, DC promo can only do unattended installs from a command line. You cannot do interactive installs with DC promo any longer. All right, so just straight away there, installing the domain controllers is different. Then we have create and manage objects. Now here's where it actually gets a little bit easier. I don't think there's probably that many people in this room who have never created a user account before or a computer account before or maybe even a group account before. And the good news is that's pretty straightforward here, although you've got more choices about how you want to get that done. You can still use AD users of computers. That's not a problem. Can anyone think of any other ways? PowerShell, yeah. What about, there's another management tool. ADAC, Active Directory Administration Center. Okay, that first came in on 2008 R2. If you skip that one, if you never saw it or you just didn't use it, get familiar with ADAC because that's like one of our primary tools now. They want us to use more of that sort of stuff rather than AD users of computers, actually. So AD, what kind of stuff can we do in ADAC that ADAC cannot do? Yeah, recycle bin's a good shout. Anything else? Recovering deleted objects, obviously, to do with that sort of stuff. Fine-grained password policies, I believe you can do in there as well. So there's a bunch of stuff you can do in ADAC that you cannot do in AD users' computers. And the reason for that is ADAC is running those PowerShell commands underneath. All right? So also get familiar with the PowerShell commands. And I've said that before. Yes, chap here. I'm sorry, say that a little bit louder. Oh, can I add a display specifier in ADAC? Honestly, I can't think. Come and see me afterwards. I can't remember. I can check it out. We can have a look on one in a minute. I wouldn't have thought so. If I don't know it off the top of my head, probably not. But check for yourself. So some relatively simple things here, but be aware of the new methods, folks. Adding users, adding computers. Some of you have done that hundreds of times. You can probably do it in your sleep, but can you do it in 2012? Can you do it via PowerShell? Can you do it also via bulk import? That's something we ask of you as well. We need to know that not just you can create one user, but how would you create 1,000 users? Yeah, you're not just going to do that by hand. You're going to want to use things like this chap over here said, CSVDE is one method. We could use that for adding users and computers and so on. But also PowerShell, okay? New-AD user, new-AD computer, those kinds of commandlets you need to be familiar with. You might want to build those into PowerShell scripts that go ahead and read an import file of usernames and go and build a whole bunch of users off the back of that. Also over here, we've got creating and managing OUs and groups. Again, this is all bread and butter stuff, but new methods of how to accomplish that. So if you've added an OU before, how would I do that from PowerShell? I'm testing you here because you really need to know this stuff. How would I add an organizational unit from PowerShell? New-organizational unit. Yeah, it's like the name suggests. Yep, those kinds of things. So easy marks to be had here if you know the right stuff. Okay, but OUs are important for several reasons. Make sure you know what those are. We use OUs to control delegation of admin, and we use OUs for group policy. Okay, so there are reasons around why we'd need to set them up in a certain way. It's not just because they look nice on screen. We usually have them set up for a couple of kind of management reasons. Check out Hands-on Lab 300 as well, by the way, for this category. Okay, quick question for you then on Active Directory before we move on to our last section. Here we have all domain controllers running Server 2008 R2 at present. You install a Server 2012 server. You need to promote the server to a domain controller, and you need to use the install from media, IFM, option. Okay, what should you do? Well, just before we answer that, what do we mean by that? We need to install a domain controller using the install from media option. What does that mean? Yeah, so basically you've got a backup set of an existing domain controller and you want to provision a new domain controller using the backup set of the other DC. Why would you do that? Yeah, you're going to minimize replication. You're going to have the bulk of the AD data in your backup set, you can load that in. So when you build your domain controller, it's like 99% correct anyway. And then you can just replicate the minor differences that have occurred since your backup was taken. Okay, so that's good for branch office deployments, for example. Okay, so what should we do here then is the question. Should we create a system state backup from a 2008 R2 server? Should we upgrade one of the existing Server 2008 domain controllers to Server 2012 and then create an IFM backup? Or should we create an IFM backup from an existing 2008 R2 backup? Oh, we're not sure here. Oh, the answer is B. You upgrade one of the existing domain controllers first, then you can create an IFM backup from there. It's not so much that. It's the backup set is different. It's not so much the schema. By the by. But actually, by the way, when you've mentioned schema here, that's something that's just jogged my memory. If I can just go back a slide here, installing domain controllers, there's something very important I forgot to say actually here, which is we need to prepare before 2012 servers can be installed. There's some stuff we need to do. I almost forgot. Who can tell me what I've missed? We need to do AD prep. Yeah, we need to upgrade our Active Directory that we already have. Before we can start installing our first Server 2012 domain controller, we have to ready the Active Directory for that. So we need to use AD prep. And there's a couple of command line switches that go with that. Go seek them out if you're not sure what they are. Okay, I can tell you afterwards if you want to know, but go find them out. What does AD prep do? Write a note here and go check it out. Why would I need to use AD prep? What are the switches I would use with that and why? If you're not sure what those are, go find that information out or see me afterwards. Okay, let's move on to our very last section here. The last section in the OD area is create and manage group policy. And this is an area that's very close to my heart. I do a lot of this pretty much week in, week out. So we need to understand here how we go about adding group policies, the GPOs as we call them. We typically use group policy management console for this. Are there any other ways? PowerShell, of course. New-GPO. yep. But we need to understand some of the basics. Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute that you must catalog in your brain every single setting in GPO, because that's just impossible. But there are a few sections particularly that are called out here on the OD, such as app locker, security settings, UAC settings. They're on the exam webpage. I just don't have them all on my slide here. Software restriction policies. There's just an edited few of those that you really, really, really do need to know. But what you more above anything else need to know is, how do I set them up? How do I set up stuff like security on them so that they only apply to certain computers or certain users? How do I link one to an OU so that only certain people are covered by that policy instead of everybody on my network? So you need to know what I would call the mechanics of GPO. You need to know how to set them up, how to link them, unlink them. You can link the same policy more than once to different containers and to different domains. So make sure you're fluent in those areas. Make sure you know how to do what we call security filtering. That's where we change the access control list on a GPO to say it only applies to these computers over here. Okay? So make sure you're very rounded in that. And also the whole GPMC is top to bottom, really. Make sure you understand that console top to bottom. For example, there's something called the central store and starter GPOs. Those areas catch people out sometimes. I get people coming up to me after studying, and they go, I didn't know what that was. I've never done a central store before. I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. I had to guess on that because I didn't know what that was about. So does anyone know what is a central store? Yep, chap at the back. Yeah. Exactly. So ADM files and that kind of thing that traditionally go in there, instead of those being stored on a per policy basis, they're stored as a single instance. It makes for more lean and mean replication. It cuts down the replication time and file storage space on your domain controller. So it's a sensible thing to do. You just need to do it. All right? It doesn't do it for you. You need to create the central store manually. Computers, client computers, can pick up on that once you've done it, as long as they're running Windows Vista or higher. But the server itself needs to be provisioned for that. It's a simple thing to do, and it's a one-time task. But somebody's got to do it, and that person is you if you're doing the 410 exam. Yes?
When new versions come, you need to add the updated.
Yeah, you need to refresh it from time to time as well. I don't know if that's going to be covered on this exam, but certainly about creating the store, those kinds of tasks to do with provisioning in the first place, we're definitely going to measure those on the test here. Okay, yep. Oh, XP, get out of here, come on. XP, seriously? No, they have to be Vista or higher clients. I don't think...
So ME's out of the question.
ME, come on. We need to have a talk afterwards.
Is there Bob support?
Huh?
Is there Bob
Get out of here.
What about starter GPOs?
Starter GPOs, that's on here as well. Starter GPOs are on here too. Starter GPOs, I kind of think I've like a template. I can copy and paste one. So if I've got like three or four policies I need to provision that are broadly the same, I can create a starter GPO and clone from there and then do my changes just on those specific individualized policies. Simple thing to do. Again, it requires you to have done it and practice with that. So try it out three or four times so you know how it works. It's pretty straightforward, but it's not going to just do that for you. A starter GPO is made by you, all right? And then you create policies based on that. So think of it like creating from a template. It's a bit like when you make a Word document based on a .x file. It's a bit like doing that. Okay, so I've already mentioned a couple of the sections like security and app locker. So research those. Make sure you know how app locker works, especially nowadays on Server 2012, because we now got AppX files as well. You know, the Windows Store apps. AppX files are included in here as well, so we can actually cover your in-house developed AppX applications, like the Windows Store ones. And we've also got the firewall mentioned here. The firewall needs to be configured sometimes on a server manually, or sometimes again through group policy. Okay, or maybe you're configuring the firewall for your client machines, whatever. The interface is actually the same. If you go into the group policy and you go to the firewall section, it's very much the same as doing it on a single computer anyway. So if you know it in one, you know it in the other. But make sure you know how to set up things like inbound rules, outbound rules, and also one that catches people out, connection security rules for IPsec. If you haven't done those, you don't know what that is, go do some research. Connection security rules are what we use for IPsec policies, okay? So you need to know how to set those up to block or allow connections based on IPsec parameters, All right, so we cover all of that in the Windows firewall. It's not just about opening and shutting ports, it's about connection rules as well. Okay. Also be aware of how to do that from the command line too. NetSH, for example. In the OD document, they talk about being able to import and export firewall settings from one computer to another. We use things like NetSH and the advanced firewall subcategory to do that. All right, so use your command line as well as the GUI. Okay, so I've gone through the six OD areas with you here. I'm just going to give you a few other bits of information before we wrap up here, which is, did you notice something here as we went along? Hopefully a few things. But specifically, there was one word that came up more than anything else. What was that word? No? On the screens, I mean. Configure, all right? Most of these areas are about configuring, all right? So my tip to you is, get your hands on, all right? Whether it's on hands-on labs downstairs or on your own test computers, get your hands dirty. You must understand how things get configured. You need to have the practical experience of actually doing this stuff. Reading a white paper is great, and it's one thing to do that, but you actually have to roll your sleeves up and practice this out, because we'll assess you on how do you configure that? Where do you go to set that? Whereabouts do you do this? How do you link that? What box do you tick to do this? We'll ask you those kinds of things on that test. How do we get there? Okay. In one slide's time. Okay, one slide's time. Bear with me. So I have a call to action for you folks, and most of you are sold on this anyway by virtue of you being here, but my big call to action for you folks is go and book it. 50% discount on exams here at TechEd if you didn't already know that. But my personal motivator is putting my money on the line, putting my money where my mouth is. When I book it and I actually have it scheduled in my calendar, then I know I'm going to study. For some of you, get that done this week. Or get it done when you go home, but actually book it. Book it in, because that focuses the brain once the money is on the line, okay? Especially if your boss is waiting for a good result off the back of that. So go book it. We've got the exam center open all week, just across the way here, and you can just walk straight in, and 5 minutes later, you can be doing the test if you want. We've got practice tests right next door as well, so if you want to try this out, the 4, 10, 11, and 12 are all covered in the practice tests. So if you want to just check it out beforehand, that's a good way of revising and seeing finding out what you don't know. Use that to sort of highlight the areas that you're not really good at, and then practice on those. We've also got a couple of other books that I would suggest. Let me just go on to those first. We've actually got a little library in the exam area as well. So if you want to take some books home, we're doing those on a one-day loan period. So as long as you sort of take it out today, you hand it back tomorrow, that's good. It's just on a kind of honors system, but we'll take your name and stuff. We've got a couple of books here. We've got a 410 book. I've already given out about 3 copies of that yesterday to people, so some of those should be coming back in, so go run. If you can't find those up here, go to the booth downstairs on the show floor. Go find the Microsoft Learning folks down there. We've got the same library down there as well, and they can loan you out from downstairs too. All right, so go have a look at those. We've specifically got exam reference guides that will cover in much more detail than I've had time to do the stuff on the test. So definitely go seek those out. We have one for 417 likewise as well. We've mentioned a couple of things like labs, if I can just go back. So go have a look at the hands-on labs. Go have a look at other sessions that are here this week while you're here. If you want to speak to me or one of the other ambassadors, the guys in the green shirts, come and find us. We're all up on this floor, and we're all here all week. Okay, so come and see me. Yes, sir? Electronically, there's some good stuff like the server guide from Mitch Tulloch. He's got his guide up that you can get from MS Press. Thank you. Okay. Go see us also. We've got the Safari books that you can access as well through the Certification Central, so go and see us over there for that stuff too, for electronic stuff. What else have you got here? Really good resource, Microsoft Virtual Academy. If you haven't used it, go check it out. There's some awesome stuff on there on Windows Server above and beyond what you guys need to know for the 410, but we've specifically got lots of courses on Server 2012 on there. Go check them out. If you've used them before, you'll know they're valuable. They point you to some really good resources, and there's self-checking questions through those modules as well, so you can see how you're getting on. I would definitely urge you to have a look at that. It's microsoftvirtualacademy.com. It's free to use. You've got a whole bunch of resources in there for free. You can go study. So definitely use that as a study resource. Okay. Also, this session, as I said before, is being recorded, so you can check it out later. We're going to do a repeat of this on Wednesday as well, which is EXM 13. We have the 4.11 and 4.12 coming up straight afterwards, so I'm going to wrap up now. If I can just ask you again just to complete your evals for the session here, if you don't mind. This is EXM01. So do complete that. You know there's prizes you can win off the back of that as well, so please do that. Thanks very much for your time. If you have any questions, please stick around or come and find me outside afterwards a little bit later on in Certification Central. Thank you very much, folks.